Commissioners of Rio Grande, I mean, excuse me, Rio Blanco County versus ExxonMobil. And we're ready to hear from the petitioner.
Your Honor, may it please the court, Malcolm M. Murray on behalf of the appellant, Rio Blanco County. This is a case that requires the court to define construction and building materials as that term is utilized in the use tax statute, section 29-2-109(1). Let me start, though, by addressing very specifically the issue that was presented in the writ for cert. It is, are materials and equipment that are used in the extraction and processing of natural gas, construction and building materials subject to the use tax that local governments can impose? The simple answer to that question is only those materials that become or utilized to construct improvements to real property are subject to the use tax. Obviously, there are a number of materials, equipment, chemicals, items that are used in the extraction and processing of natural gas, but those are not subject to the use tax. I want to start out there. Drill rigs, furniture, laptop computers, chemicals that are used in the drilling process or in the processing process, those are not subject to the use tax. On the other hand, what we are dealing with in Rio Blanco County with ExxonMobil is a structure that goes from the bottom of each well bore that includes concrete, casing, pipe to the surface, and then along the surface, and then later under the surface. It is a series of pipelines, a series of components that make up a single structure that goes from the bottom of the well bore to the point at which the natural gas is delivered to the interstate pipeline.
Mr. Murray, can I interrupt you for a minute and ask you to address sort of what I think is a preliminary issue, and that is the trial court, as I understand it, bifurcated
these
proceedings, and that kind of casts this appeal into a light where it is sort of a broad question as opposed to the factual. I just wonder if you could introduce that to me a little bit so that
sure.
I understand a little better what we are, why we are in our context and
sure.
what we are not addressing.
At the outset of this case, the ExxonMobil made it clear that they were, it was their contention that none of the facilities there, nothing that had been constructed, nothing at all was subject to the use tax. I think that their argument in part was that they were, for instance, trade fixtures, that they did not amount to improvements to real property, that that the use tax was not intended to apply to industrial facilities or components. That was really the basis that they challenged the county's use tax, and because of the number of components that we would be dealing with, the number of purchases of individual items that had been incorporated into this structure, it seemed to make more sense to set aside the very time-consuming and very detailed process of going through all of those items if their argument at the outset was that none of them were subject to use tax. And that's why, at the outset, we agreed to bifurcate this case.
So does that leave open the question about when the levy can actually be made for the use tax? Would you just explain to me what the county's position on that is? Does it have to be in the ground? Is it equipment being delivered at a site? When does the tax get levied?
The tax gets levied in accordance with the use tax resolution that says that it is tangible personal property that is stored, used, or consumed and intended to become a part of, attached to, or a component of a building. Basically, what we're saying, and I don't think this is an issue in the case, what we're saying is that the tax falls on that tangible personal property at the point where it's delivered on site, with the intention that it become a part of, attached to, or a component of a building structure, road, or pertinence. But I don't think that has not been raised as an issue in this litigation.
Thank you.
Council, can I get you to return to your earlier discussion of the bifurcation?
Sure.
So essentially, what the district court is addressing is whether anything falls within the use tax, correct?
Correct.
Kind of as a general matter. And your answer, I guess, to that is some of it does.
Some of it certainly does. Absolutely. And I think that we think a fair amount of it does. There are items, obviously, that do not fall within the definition of an improvement to real property, and those are not taxed, and we don't purport to tax those.
Okay, then just as a follow-up, can you help me understand, if we agree with you that some of it does, then what happens?
Then what happens is that the case needs to be remanded to the district court to determine which items meet the definition that you determine. In other words, we are suggesting to you that you reach a result that defines construction and buildings materials as those items that are used to construct an improvement to real property. An improvement to real property, we are proposing to you, you accept the commonly accepted case law definition, which we think is entirely consistent with the legislative intent. And if you do that, then this case will be returned to the district court, and we will get an item, hopefully we will get an itemization at that point of what items were purchased and delivered on site during this particular period. And we will go through those and ultimately present evidence to the court as to whether those items meet the definition. At this point, we don't have a detailed itemization of what items were purchased and brought to the site during the applicable period.
Well, and I understand that there's no kind of case-by-case examination here by reason of this bifurcated procedure, but can you help me understand what particular items you think count as improvements to real property?
Oh, absolutely. For instance, let's start with the well bore itself. After the well is drilled, casing pipe is put into the well bore. Concrete is poured into it to hold open that well bore and to hold the pipe in place. There is pipe to hold the bore in place. There's other pipe that's used to extract the natural gas on the surface. And there are photographs, extensive photographs in the record, extensive photographs of the surface facilities. Many of them, there are pipes, there are tanks, there are valves. They're all attached to one another with bolts or welded together. There's then a pipeline that is buried 4 to 8 feet under the ground, various pipelines that go to the processing plant where water is separated from the natural gas. There is a separate water disposal facility with storage tanks, pipes, and wells to re-inject the water. And then there is a very extensive and very expensive processing plant that is the prime issue in this litigation. And it is a series of pipes, facilities, tanks that are used in the processing of this natural gas. Again, they are all tied together. They are part of an integrated structure. They are either welded or attached with bolts that are amply illustrated in the photographs and the records. And ultimately, the natural gas goes. It is that structure that is an issue here.
Mr. Murray, may I follow up on that question? Because I too am having a little trouble just picturing. And at the back of your brief, Appendix 1, you, for example, have a picture dated August 2nd, 2006. Perhaps you have that.
Yes, Your Honor.
I like it better than the picture that comes before it. So here's my question. Is there anything in that picture that you think would not be taxable? I'll give you a moment to catch it, because so far it seems like, you know, paper, pencils, legal pads, those kinds of things you agree aren't taxable.
Absolutely.
But so now if we look at this picture, is there anything here that's not taxable? This looks like those might be lights or something on top of those.
Those might be lights. The definition of improvement that you're proposing.
Okay.
So how,
like, say I was the trial judge and I took the opinion that you want us to write, and I looked at this picture, what would I be, how would I be differentiating?
I think that the essential, the important thing is I would be looking to whether a component, any of the components that you see here, are they permanently attached, affixed, or annexed to the property? And when I say permanently, permanence means, are they intended to remain there for the useful life of this property? In other words, to perform that function, or until the property itself is put to a different use, or the item is replaced by something else, by an item, a component that is better suited for that. The second question I'm going to ask is are any of these components, or are all of those components, essential and integral to the purpose of extracting and processing natural gas?
That's the real question.
And
I beg your pardon. Let me just make sure I clarify this. Do they? You require an and. They need to be permanent and integral and essential.
And essential. And the third element of that we are suggesting to you, that is well accepted in the extensive case law, is that it add to the enhance the value or utility of the property. So that's the.
So now, if we
that I as the trial judge am going to utilize, and I'm going to look at each one of these components.
Sure, and I'm being pretty literal, and I beg your pardon for this, but let's just continue with this picture. So, for example, these lights, they are permanent for the life of the project.
Mm-hmm.
I guess you have to have lights in order to do this project. Therefore, they're integral and essential.
I think if these are security lights, I would assume, and I don't know that there was testimony,
sure.
I would assume that there needs to be 24-hour access, and these need to be lighted.
And but they don't necessarily enhance anything, do they? I mean, you just need them for the project.
I think the property itself, the structure, the overall structure, adds value to this property. It enhances its utility. If this particular site didn't have this oil and gas extraction facility on it, it would be marginal grazing land. It would be real well suited for deer, antelope,
but isn't that
and game hunting.
Isn't that a good argument? And maybe this is the position you are in fact taking, which I'm kind of testing by looking at this picture. But isn't that a good argument for just saying, if it has to do with this project and it's on the ground, it should be taxable, as opposed to something that can be carried away day in and day out, like a laptop or a phone or pieces of paper?
The test that we are urging you to is a three-part test, and it is and between each of those three parts. It's got to be permanently affixed, attached, or annexed to the property. It's got to be essential and integral to the functioning of the property for its intended use. And then finally, it has to be the property itself, the improvements there have to enhance the value add to the utility of the property.
So under that definition, probably nothing in this picture would not be taxable. Everything would be taxable, is a better way to put it.
Very possible.
That would be your position.
That would be our position.
Okay.
Well, no, let me understand, though. You've not had any determination on this, and you have a little battle of the footnotes, I think, with opposing counsel, who says you got a lot of things in your pictures that aren't at issue.
I don't want to try to make a determination based on these photographs. These photographs were attached to this brief for the purpose of showing that similar types of facilities have been characterized by other courts as being improvements to real property. That's why this relatively sketchy photograph is attached at the end as part of Appendix 2. It was referred to in a case from California that talked extensively about an oil and gas processing facility not vastly unlike the one that we're dealing with here. And it came to the conclusion that that facility was itself an improvement to real property. We cited another case out of Texas that deals with oil and gas facilities the same way, reached the conclusion, applying the test that I've indicated to you earlier about being the fixture attached, integral and essential, enhancing the value or utility, and determining that those meet the test of being an improvement to real property.
Council, before you move on to that, can you just help me understand, though, the jump between the statutory language, construction or building materials, and your improvement to real property argument? Can you just tie your argument to the statutory language for me?
Sure. And it's important to recognize that both the Court of Appeals and the District Court were very explicit in saying that the tax should only fall on improvements to real property. Their problem was that they didn't properly define what improvements to real property were. But the reason why that's important is I could go out tonight and go down to Home Depot, and I could buy lumber, pipe, nuts, bolts, wire, a lot of things that you and I in common parlance would say are construction and building materials. I could take those and I could build something that is not an improvement to real property, that I could carry around, that would not enhance the value or utility of any piece of property. I mean, it's possible to do that. So the problem, and I think both sides in this litigation have grappled with the fact that construction and building materials is a very broad, amorphous concept. But I think when you look at the legislative history, as well as the application of it, what was really intended, and I think we, like I said, the Court of Appeals and the District Court agree that we're limiting it to construction and building materials that are used to build an improvement to real property. If that's the case, then you need to properly define what an improvement to real property is.
Mr. Murray?
Yes.
If we accept your definition of your three components of the use tax statute, how do you deal with your argument that you just made, that you have to look, you're making the briefs, it's ambiguous as well as you look at legislative history. How do you deal with the basic principle that as far as taxation is concerned, you know, there has to be not beyond the clear import of the language used, and any doubts will be construed against the government and in favor of the taxpayer?
Well, I think in this particular instance,
aren't we really redefining what the statute says? And
no, not at all. I think actually, if anything, we're limiting what the statute says. As I just indicated, construction and building materials, and as you and I would commonly talk about it, would include a lot of things at Home Depot. But what the county has done is narrowed it. And we're saying, yes, it's appropriate to narrow that concept, but what at root is being intended here, we believe, and we're not stretching it, is materials that are used to construct improvements to real property. then you have to look at what is an improvement to real property. And the problem that the Court of Appeals and the District Court had is that they didn't come up with a meaningful definition of improvement to real property. What we are saying, what the county is proposing to you, is look to extensive case law from this court, from the Court of Appeals, from courts in other states that have consistently applied and found, determined what is an improvement to real property and adopt that definition. We're also saying, look to the legislative history to give you some context here. It is important to understand that in 1973, this state was confronting a good deal of growth along the Front Range, in particular, a lot of residential growth. The 1973 use tax statute was limited to statutory municipalities. And the impact, the growth impact that was being encountered was that from residential construction. 1975, there was a proposal to expand the scope of the use tax from statutory municipalities to include counties as well. And there was a comment, and it's a very important comment, from Representative Morgan Smith, saying that the use tax could be used by those counties, and specifically called out Rio Blanco County, that were being impacted by oil shale development. So I think there is clear, you know, this is one legislator speaking, but that's the extent of the legislative history we have for the 1975 amendment. But it makes sense. It makes sense in the context of what was going on at the time. The other piece of the legislative history I'd like to highlight is the conversation in, I believe it was the House Committee, about washing machines and refrigerators. And the conclusion that was reached between the two legislators was that the original washing machine and refrigerator were construction and building materials. Replacements were not. And that's consistent with the approach that the county has taken.
Well, let me just ask again. Are we being asked to basically construe the Rio Blanco County resolution in light of the statute and to see whether it's valid?
I think that's
they're
what,
under.
That that's, is, that, that's what Exxon
this is in, it's somewhat in the nature of a definitive question of law. Now, in having to do with the further proceedings to sort out what is taxable and what is not taxable.
Correct.
Is that right? Will the
correct
trial court do that sorting?
Trial court will need to do that sorting. This will not, if the county prevails, this will not be the end of this case. It will be remanded for a detailed consideration of whatever you define as construction and building materials are the items that ExxonMobil has purchased and brought to the site. They included it.
And it's your position that this county resolution here is narrowing over the statute itself.
Yes.
Then would you just explain to me what the term appurtenance means? Has it got any definition apart from just the word appearing there in the resolution?
I can't tell you that it has been applied in particular in Rio Blanco County. This resolution has been applied to building structures and roads. I really can't respond to whether appurtenance is
okay
superfluous in this context.
Could I ask one question as well about this narrowing versus broadening in terms of the definitions? Would it be your position then that any improvements to real property must involve construction and building materials?
Yes.
Okay, so you've limited building and construction materials to those that are used as part of improvements. Then you go on and deal with that definition in terms of what constitutes an improvement.
Yes.
So the presumption there is anything that constitutes an improvement must necessarily be a building or construction material.
The improvements are made up of components of materials that are incorporated into it. and all of those materials and components that are incorporated into it, that are essential and integral to that structure, building or road, or are made up of construction and building materials.
Okay, but and I guess the question that I'm still having a little trouble fixing in my mind is, even the way you answered that question was in terms of buildings or construction to a road. Are those the only things that would be included within the notion of improvements to property?
No. Any kind of structure, for instance, a tower is a structure. Frankly, that wellbore is a structure. It's an underground structure, but it is a structure nonetheless. That pipeline is a structure. It is, and it is a structure in itself, but it is a part of a much larger structure to which it is attached, just as the plumbing in your house is a component of your house.
And is it's just one follow-up on that. So then we wouldn't classify anything as an improvement to real property unless it involved such a structure. Is that what you're saying?
I would be hard-pressed to define an improvement to real property that wasn't in some way a structure. The bridge is a structure. It's an improvement to real property. Component of what we are dealing with here is a structure.
Okay.
Your Honor, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Neil Pomeranz, FAR number 24741, on behalf of the respondent, ExxonMobil Oil Corporation. This case involves a unique tax within the state of Colorado, a tax imposed only in Colorado's statutory cities and within approximately one-third of Colorado's counties. The tax is far different from the traditional sales and use tax that is in effect at the state level and in virtually every home rule city, a tax that applies to all tangible personal property. The subject use tax, by contrast, applies only to two narrow categories, motor vehicles and construction and building materials. And as you are aware, the issue before the court today is whether items of equipment and materials that ExxonMobil uses within its business to extract and process natural gas fall within that second category, construction and building materials, what we refer to in our briefs as CBM for short. The standard governing interpretation of the subject statute is one that this court has applied consistently over a period of many decades. Because the case concerns the scope of the tax imposition provision, any doubt that is found to exist about the reach of this tax should be resolved in the taxpayer's favor. Three independent tribunals have now concluded that none of the subject items are CBM. The State Department of Revenue reached that determination following an evidentiary hearing, applying its expertise in the administration of sales and use tax provisions.
When you say evidentiary, what was the evidence? They didn't look at things specifically. They were looking this more as a matter of law as well, weren't they?
At the Department of Revenue, they did look at individual items. There was presentation about all of the major pieces of equipment that were used out at this site.
And they determined that nothing was taxable?
That nothing was taxable, yes. And nothing constituted construction of those materials.
Okay.
Mr. Pomeranz, that confused me just a little bit about our standard of review. I thought the use statute said that it's de novo review. Is that incorrect? Because there are findings of fact that are contained in the...
No, you're absolutely right. The district court conducted a de novo trial and reached the same conclusion. But there was a prior hearing at the Department of Revenue level.
So this is a mixed... Our review is a mixed question of law and fact, right?
Yes, there's certainly critical facts involved. And I think, you know, in that regard, I'd like to address the issue of what happened when we bifurcated the proceedings here. I think the bifurcation was intended to determine at the trial that we've already conducted, whether any of the items at issue were construction and building materials. The only thing that was reserved for a second phase, if necessary, was a computation of the amount of tax that would be due on those items that were determined to be taxable. We went through very lengthy presentation of evidence about all the major pieces of equipment that were at this site, 20 or 30 odd pieces of equipment. We didn't go through every nut and bolt, but all of the major items of equipment were described in detail to the district court, and the conclusion was that none of it was construction and building materials. So from my perspective, from our perspective, what this court would be doing is determining whether or not, based upon that record, and based upon any standard that's established here for construction building materials, whether any of these major items are in fact CBM, and if so, the remand would determine how much tax is due on those items.
Well, that's, I think...
Are you saying whether anything is taxable, or whether and which items are taxable? Because you seem to be making a slightly different, or presenting a slightly different understanding of the bifurcation than Mr. Murray argued. Are you intending to do that, or am I hearing you differently?
No, I don't think you're hearing me differently. I think the district court has already reviewed all of the major items of equipment, materials that are at this site, and determined that none of them are CBM, based upon the facts relevant to each of those items. So if this court were to determine that, for example, a storage tank is CBM, my reading of the bifurcation order is that what would be left for the district court to do on remand was to hear evidence about how much that storage tank cost, and therefore compute the tax that would be due on it.
So you are asking us to determine specifically which items are subject to the tax?
Well, I think if we were to remand for a reevaluation of the factual qualities of every piece of equipment, that's already been done. So yes, I mean, from our perspective, the role of the court now is to determine if the district court erred in deciding that a storage tank or a compressor was not construction of building materials.
All right, let me try this just a little bit. I understand that from your perspective, you want us to determine that the district court was right, Court of Appeals was right, and nothing is subject to the tax.
That's right.
However, should we decide that that's not correct and that some things are subject to it, are you asking and expecting us to determine which items are subject to it?
That is certainly our understanding of the bifurcation order, that the only thing, and I believe this is how it's written, that the only thing that would be reserved for phase two, if you will, the computation of taxes due based upon the taxable items.
I'm confused, Ms. Pomerantz. What's our standard of review of the district court? You took evidence, district court made findings of fact and made conclusions of law that nothing was CBM, right? So what's our standard of review right now?
I think it's deference to the district court on the facts.
On a factual basis?
On the facts that were established, correct?
What are the conclusions of law that we reviewed de novo?
The conclusion being that none of the items for which the factual record has been established fall within the scope of construction and building materials, those words that appear in section 29.2.109. That's the legal determination, is that none of them are construction and building materials as used in that statute.
What are we supposed to do with the county resolution?
I think the county resolution is only enforceable to the extent it's consistent with the state statute. We don't think it is. So I think the role of the court would be to articulate what the proper definition of construction and building materials is, the term used in the state statute, and the county resolution is enforceable only to the extent that it's consistent with that definition.
So you've heard Mr. Murray present an argument about what he sees as a three-part test. And what was the test that the trial court, district court, and the Court of Appeals applied?
I think what you see in the lower court decisions is, I believe, three different themes that are consistent with the way real property and personal property have been distinguished by the Department of Revenue and the courts over many decades. Okay. Those three prongs are, one, let me back up a moment and say that I think ExxonMobil is in agreement with the county only to this extent. But we believe that one element of becoming a construction and building material is that an item become real property or an improvement to real property. The county talks about it only in terms of improvements. We would say real property or improvements there too. But that's one defining characteristic, one requirement of what construction and building materials are. In that regard, the lower courts, I think, articulated two elements of what an improvement is or what real property is based upon precedent. One is the item has to lose its individual identity as personality in becoming real property or an improvement to real property. That notion is not new. You can find it in the Department of Revenue regulation that defines tangible personal property. The regulation is 39-26-102.15. That's one of the defining elements of what is personal property and what is real property. To be real property, you have to lose your separate identity as personal property. So that concept comes up, I think, in both the district court and the Court of Appeals decision.
Can you give me an example of what you mean by that?
Something that loses its identity?
Yes.
Sure. Bricks in a home, wood in a home, the pipes behind the wall in a home.
I think Mr. Murray was arguing that they don't really lose their identity. A piece of board is still a piece of board.
Right, and that's certainly always...
A door is a door.
You can always single out and say, you know, that's a floor, there's wood in the floor, there behind your walls are pipes. But the way that principle has been applied, certainly, is to say, look, you look at it and you say they've been integrated into something larger, into something bigger, into something different. They're no longer described as a floor plus a door plus a pipe behind the wall. It's described as a home or an office building or a school. So that's the first concept, losing individual identity.
So none of this is taxable?
No.
How can that be? We're looking at a whole lot of structures here. We're looking at stairs, for example, and pipes and things that are concrete cemented to the ground, bolted in.
Well, because the factual record below is that virtually all of these items, some of them big, some of them small, are readily movable.
But that's true of a house, too. You can pull the piping out of a house. You can pull the floors up.
Well,
take it apart brick by brick.
I wouldn't say readily.
It just seems like, we need a definition, not just sort of almost like alchemy thing.
Well... The record below, let me try to draw a distinction between this type of equipment and the items in your home. The record below showed that virtually all of the items of equipment here are designed specifically so that they can be moved and relocated with relative ease. So most of the equipment sits on metal skids. They're brought to the site, they're dropped into place on a metal skid. When they're moved, replaced, they're taken out on the metal skid. Many of them have roll bars in place.
But that's after the play is made, right? I mean, after the resource has been depleted beyond its economic recovery value, right? Isn't the purpose of these facilities, these structures, very important to the analysis here? I mean, certainly you don't move these things while you've got a producing gas field that's interconnected with all these facilities, do you?
Well, the gas field is shut down on a regular basis as a gas processing unit has to be taken out and replaced, or a pipe has to be moved to a different location, or a compressor is swapped out for something else. Surely the gas running through that piece of equipment is stopped for the moment. But the point is that the record shows that not only are they designed so that they can be moved with relative ease, but they are in fact on a regular basis. There's perhaps dozens of examples in the record below that shows where compressors were moved, storage tanks were moved, pipes were relocated from one place to another. That's what our field foreman talked about is field dynamics. This is an evolving process out there. It's not as the county would describe it, a bunch of equipment that's dropped into place and left there for 30 years. Simply not the case.
But some of it was left for 50 years, which is sometimes longer than a lot of houses. Right?
Yeah.
So how does that not become part of the realty?
Because it doesn't meet the traditional standard that's used to determine whether something's real property or personal property. It doesn't just go to length of time in one location. It goes, again, to whether or not it loses its separate identity to become incorporated into something else. I might have a laptop that I choose to keep in one place for 20 years. Seems unlikely, but I hope you see the point. That doesn't make it any more real property than the computer that's only in place for a year. It still doesn't lose its separate identity. It is a computer. It remains a computer in the same way a compressor remains a compressor.
What about the pipeline?
The pipeline, the record shows as well, is regularly moved. In fact, law requires that it's going to have to be removed to remediate the facility after.
And the project's all done?
Well, not just when it's done. Certainly when it's done, all of it has to come out. But the testimony at trial was that the pipe is often pulled out, either for repair or simply to move it as field dynamics warrant.
Then the cement and all that?
The cement in the well bore, the testimony is that some of the casing is cemented into place, some is not. The amount, the portion that's cemented into the case probably will remain there forever.
How much of Rio Blanco County is public lands? Give me a rough percentage.
I would suspect a majority. I think the testimony in our case, the record was that 95% of the land that ExxonMobil operates on is federally owned land.
All right, and that land is not taxable, of course, right? I mean, under the federal law. Now, what I'm getting at here is the time period in which this was enacted in the legislative history would indicate that this county in particular, but other counties on the West Slope were high impact areas having to do with energy development, in particular oil shale. Now, how does that legislative policy, if you would acknowledge that that is so, factor in or not factor into our analysis of what the legislature intended? Assuming that the tax burden would have to be assumed by private sources, other sources in the county, to build the kind of infrastructure which is necessary to make this kind of industry function. Of course, now it's mainly oil and gas, but, you know, the impact were energy impacts.
I don't think that this tax was created with any one particular industry in mind or not in mind. I think when you read the legislative history, what you see is this is truly a unique tax. It was ultimately established as a compromise. It started off, the original language for this tax would have been the traditional use tax, a tax on all tangible personal property. That's the way the tax bill was originally drafted. There's a lot of testimony about the difficulty of that would be created if businesses had to track property as it moved from one local taxing jurisdiction to another. And so the committee discussions are clear that they wanted to address those problems, yet still secure a certain amount of revenue for taxing jurisdictions. At one point, there's a discussion about how the revised narrow tax, some of the legislatures felt, would still capture between 50 and 60% of the tax that would have been captured under the original broader tax on all tangible personal property. But there was a trade-off. There was a specific trade-off that was made to limit the tax, not to have it apply to all tangible personal property, but only to these two narrow categories, motor vehicles and construction and building materials. And I think there's two main aims at work there. One is, these categories were not chosen by coincidence. Construction and building materials was chosen in part because these would be items that would not be subject to movement. Therefore, they would not have to be tracked as they moved from one local taxing jurisdiction to another. It would eliminate that problem that the legislators were presented with. The second reason that the legislators chose these two categories is they felt that they could be accommodated within already existing reporting requirements. Tax on motor vehicles could be paid when the motor vehicle is registered. Tax on construction and building materials could be paid when the building permit is full. So no coincidence that these are the two categories that ended up in the final legislation. And in fact, that's the way taxes on construction materials are reported and paid in most parts of this state, even at the home rule level. Almost all the home rule cities require that taxes be paid on construction materials when the building permit is pulled. The testimony below was that of the 20 other counties that have this exact same tax on construction and building materials, 18 of them limit the tax to projects for which a building permit is required. That's how they determine whether tax is due. That's where they collect the tax when the building permit is pulled. And in fact, as we discussed in our brief, there's a lot of guidance documents that were put together by Rio Blanco County itself when they created their own tax, when they exercised their right to create a tax in the early 1980s. And they described two programs for tax that they were creating. The first one is one that we think is fully legitimate, fully lawful. That was limited to commercial and residential buildings. And that tax was coordinated with the building permit process. So it was limited to projects for which building permits were required. It was only the second program that Rio Blanco County created that really does exceed what any of these other counties, how they're applying this tax, that I think extends beyond traditional building projects for which building permits are required.
Could you tell us the second theme? You said there are two themes.
Thanks for getting me back to that. Right, so for purposes of determining, distinguishing between real property and personal property for sales and use tax purposes, which I think is really what's important here, not how improvements are defined for statutes of repose or workers' comp act provisions, but for sales and use tax purposes, the first one is loses individual identity. And just to finish off that point, that's not only stated in the Department of Revenue regulation defining tangible personal property, it's stated in a series of cases. You can find it in the Rainer Door case. That's a case we didn't cite in our briefs. It's from the 1980s. It's cited more recently in the International Paper case as a relevant standard. Okay, the second standard is, does it enhance the value of the real property generally, or does it exist to support and benefit a particular business that's conducted on the land? And that concept, that theme, is articulated in a series of Department of Revenue decisions stretching back for decades. We've collected a number of them within our exhibit binder. I think it's exhibit O, P, Q, and R. It's a standard that's been applied particularly where a lessee brings property to leased land. This follows from the Andrews and Updegraff line of cases that you've seen in the briefs. The notion being that if a lessee brings property to land solely to conduct its business, there's a heavy presumption that that remains personal property and doesn't become integrated into the realty. That's also, for what it's worth, it's a concept that's central to administration of property taxes in this state. It's probably the defining characteristic that distinguishes between personal property and improvements for the property tax arena. You can find that in the Home Depot case decided earlier this decade. You can find it in the definition of personal property that's found in 39-1-102. And if you look at the Department of Revenue decisions that what we've collected, what you see is a lot of equipment that's quite analogous to the items that are at issue in this case. Large pieces of equipment installed with a certain degree of permanence, but yet still treated as personal property for sales and use tax purposes. So one of the decisions has to do with bowling alleys that were nailed into place. Another has to do with large transmission towers. A third case had to do with a lot of oil and gas equipment. So that's a standard that has been applied in the sales and use tax arena. I want to address one of the difficulties, I think, with the county's departure from those established sales and use tax standards in fashioning what they believe should be the proper definition of improvements. As I started with, the standard sales and use tax in this state, again, at the state level in every home rule jurisdiction, is a tax on personal property, tangible personal property. That tax doesn't apply to real property, and it doesn't apply to improvements to real property. The county would have the court redefine improvement to realty for sales and use tax purposes in a way that would bring within its scope all manner of items that are traditionally understood as personal property, machinery and equipment, for example. I don't think there's any dispute in the sales and use tax community that a piece of machinery is a piece of personality. Well, it isn't an improvement to realty.
Oh, wait a second. Mr. Murray argued that it was narrowing, not broadening, and he talks about the first requirement is permanently affixed. Machinery isn't permanently affixed.
I think according to Mr. Murray's definition, all the machinery that's being used by ExxonMobil is permanent, because according to their conception of permanence, it's in place until it wears out or until it's replaced by something else that's more suitable.
Well, it's sort of like... That's the business about whether or not you call it equipment or not. I mean, what's...
Well, I'd encourage the court to look at the photographs that are in our Exhibit A, I believe. And it really does help show the individual nature of each of these items. They truly do remain pieces of equipment and machinery. A compressor remains a compressor. A gas processing unit remains a gas processing unit. You can see in one of the photographs a pad where the gas processing unit was taken out. A few bolts were unscrewed, the truck pulled up, it was carted away. Yes, all these pieces of machinery are connected together, but that's true in any factory. According to the county's formulation, all of the equipment that's in any factory presumably would also be a construction and building material because it's connected together and it serves some integrated function to benefit an activity that's conducted on the land.
How do you see the Robinson Brick Factory, the Anderson case, fitting in here? That's a conveyor belt case.
Okay.
I mean, I guess your argument is that you don't want to go to any other area of the law to look at analysis. Because that's a statute of repose case.
I think it would be a significant departure standard that has been applied in the sales and use tax world to treat a conveyor belt as real property, improvement to real property instead of personal property. And the implications, the point I was making a moment ago, are if it's classified as an improvement, then the next time that factory is sold, none of the equipment within it will be subject to sales or use tax, because again, the traditional sales and use tax applies to personal property. If it's all deemed to be an improvement to real property for sales and use tax purposes, none of it would be subject to tax anymore when the factory is sold. And as somebody who's practiced in this field for 15 years now, that strikes me as a radical departure from the norms.
Mr. Pomerantz, those big tanks, are they replaced? Are they movable?
They are. They absolutely are. And that's what the testimony shows.
What's the longevity of one of those tanks?
Well, the lifespan is long. How long does it remain on one particular site?
Yeah.
Could be a period of weeks or a period of many years. That's what the testimony shows. And if you look at the photographs, you'll see that most of those tanks just sit on the bare earth. And the testimony is that they're big pieces of equipment, and you know what they do? They pull up big trucks. And it's amazing what they can move in a short period of time to move the storage tank from this well pad to that well pad. It happens all the time. That's the record established below.
So what's your point about the moving? Is it taxed again under Rio Blanco's ordinance when it's moved to another location, or is it a one-shot deal?
It's not subject to tax. But we think movability is a critical element of whether something ceases to be personal property, okay, becomes real property.
But we don't have to face that issue. I mean, Rio Blanco County isn't asserting that every time it's moved to another location.
Oh, no, they're not trying to
get
taxed once.
And so this is a one-time taxing event. This equipment is brought in to the county for the ability to use it or consume it in the county, intended to be placed as part of a fixture improvement, et cetera, as the county defines it.
Right. I disagree with that characterization.
Well, I understand, but that's the universe we're dealing in right here. It's a one-time tax.
It's a one-time tax like any sales or use tax.
Right.
So it would be a one-time tax.
Okay. And the purpose of a use tax now is what? Why do local jurisdictions get this authority from the legislature?
Well, you know, for the longest time, counties and statutory cities had no use tax authority.
Right.
Again, as I mentioned before, this was sort of a compromise tax. It was a way to develop a certain amount of additional revenue for those statutory cities and counties, mm-hmm, but with very clear limitations in place. I mean, this is not the traditional sales and use tax that applies to all personal property that was considered and rejected. If I could, I'd like to spend my remaining few minutes here just addressing a couple of the other points that Mr. Murray made. One of our difficulties with the county's position has been that, from our perspective, there's really no boundaries to what they're proposing. They would suggest that anything that is either attached to the land itself, affixed in some way, or attached to something else that's attached to the land can fall within the concept of construction and building materials. So it's this sort of daisy chain theory of annexation connected to something else that's connected to something else. That certainly has very broad implications, as you can see in this case, where a lot of these items are sitting on the bare earth, but presumably they're connected by some pipe to something else that the county would consider affixed to the land, and therefore would qualify as taxable. Much of the county's position rests upon this notion that it's integral or essential to the use of the land, or that it enhances the utility of the property. I would suggest that they're really confusing something that's integral to the land itself with something that's integral to a business conducted on the land. What we're talking about here is business property. Again, like any type of property that's used within a factory, that doesn't enhance the land per se. It enhances the value of a business that's conducted on the land. When that business shuts down, that property has no further value to the land. It imparts no lasting value.
Does it make any difference here that we're talking about extraction of part of the property, the gas that is part of the property?
I don't think so. I think it's still a business. It's a business.
So if they were manufacturing shoes, it wouldn't make any difference, you think?
I don't think there's any difference between big pieces of equipment to manufacture shoes and big pieces of equipment that refine natural gas. In the same way, if you had a bunch of pieces of equipment strung together to process apples that came from the orchard that was next to it, that's still a business that's being conducted.
But the gas is part of the real property, right?
The gas is part of the real property, yes, in the same way, I suppose, an apple tree would be. The references that were made to some of the legislative history, the comment by Representative Smith, that was not from the contemporaneous legislative history from 1973, and I would suggest to you that in the dozens and dozens of pages of contemporaneous legislative history, the history surrounding the where this term construction building came from, there's no discussion of any type of business property as falling within the scope of this tax. There's only discussion about homes and similar types of buildings. The Smith comment that was referred to is from 1975 legislation that simply extended the tax to counties, and I believe it comes from a discussion that was all of a minute or so.
Can I ask you one more question here before you sit down and your time's about up here? This statute has a lot of specific exemptions in it for ski areas, for wood beetle kill, for renewable energy sources. Kind of indicates that the legislature is certainly open to and has legislated some types of facilities that in its public policy it wants to promote and not tax. Isn't that right? So how do we use these exemptions when we're looking at the more general term of a use tax authorized in connection with construction and building materials that appears to be pretty broad?
Yeah. Well, I don't think it's an exemption, first of all. The reference to the ski lifts, I think, is extremely instructive, and I'd ask the court to review our discussion in the briefs, because what the legislative declaration that accompanied that change said is that at least in 2000, the legislature said the tax on CBIC has never been applicable to these items. Is not applicable, it has never been applicable. And that issue came up based upon a case not unlike ours that involved large interconnected pieces of equipment, ski lifts, terminals, transfer stations, et cetera, as well as substantial subsurface concrete foundations. And the legislature's feeling in 2000 was that none of that stuff had ever been subject to the tax on CBM. And so even in the amendment to the statutory language that you'll see in section 109.1, it says the tax shall not apply. Doesn't apply in the first instance. It's not saying this would have fallen within the scope of the tax, but we're choosing to exempt it out. It's saying it simply never reaches it in the first instance. And if large pieces of equipment and concrete foundations embedded in the earth that are used for a ski lift are not subject to this tax, it's hard for us to understand why analogous equipment that's used to extract and process natural gas should be treated differently. Thank you.
Let me address very briefly a couple of comments, Mr. Pomerantz. The first is the business about losing their individual identity. Bottom line is that is meaningless. The wire in your home, the furnace, hot water heater, they retain their individual identity, but they become a part of a house in exactly the same way. The materials that we seek to tax here, the pipes, the valves, the compressors, the parts of the structure are still individual parts, but they are connected. And when they are connected, they become integrated into something larger. A gas plant, a structure that is has a very specific intent, a very specific purpose. The second issue is about enhancing the value of the real property. ExxonMobil here has a leasehold interest. That leasehold interest is enhanced, probably enhanced significantly, by the presence of the structures that are part of the extraction and processing facility that's located there. If they were to sell their leasehold, it would have more value because of the presence of those facilities there. A store is a piece of real property. It enhances the value of the business that's conducted, the merchant that occupies that store. He can fix up that store and enhance the value of his business, but he also enhances the value of the real property. Because if he goes to sell that store is going to be more valuable as a result of the enhancements. The idea that you can bifurcate the enhancements to the business that's constructed on a piece of property from the property itself just doesn't make sense. It doesn't hold up. Really, what's being requested here by ExxonMobil, which has been endorsed by the Court of Appeals, is an exemption that does not exist in the statute for industrial property, for business property, and obviously because agricultural facilities, agricultural structures are not subject to building permits because of state law, they're exempted as well. The only way that you can rationalize the lower court's holding is that they are providing an exemption to industrial facilities or an exemption for any structure building that is built without the benefit of a building permit. And the absurdity of that is that there is no uniform requirement that counties or cities impose a building permit. There are probably still some counties in Colorado that don't require building permits. Rio Blanco County could impose a building permit requirement on precisely these kind of facilities. There's no regulation at the state level that says you have to require a building permit for certain types of structures, but not other types of structures. In brief conclusion, we ask that you overturn the decision of the Court of Appeals, that you determine the definition of construction of building materials, and remand this case for further findings. Thank you.
On behalf of the court, I want to thank both counsel for your arguments. The case will stand submitted, and the court will be in recess.